Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Senator Lindsey Graham is introducing a new health reform bill today. Senator Bernie Sanders is calling for some kind of Medicare for all. What would the Senate do if they were truly listening to what health insurers want when it comes to fixing Obamacare? That's what we're talking about today. How would the companies that offer health insurance redesign health care if they had control or a lot of influence? Two guests. I'd like to hear from you as well. If you had the ear of your health insurer, what would you tell them about what you like or don't like, what you need from your health insurance? If you had the ear, if you had a moment with the CEO of your health insurance company, what would you say to them about your own health insurance, maybe how that fits into the larger picture we're talking about today? What you want, what you don't want, what you like, what you don't like about your insurance? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. I'm on Twitter at Carrie NPR. Sabrina Corlett is with us. She's a research professor at Georgetown Center on Health Insurance Reform, and she joins us today from Washington. Sabrina, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Good morning.
J.B. Silvers is with us. He's a professor of health finance at Case Western Reserve. He's a former CEO of the health insurance company QualChoice that was based in Cleveland, Ohio, and he's with us today from Cleveland. And J.B., welcome to you. It's good to have you on the show.
Hi, good to be here.
Sabrina, I remember how deeply involved and influential health insurers were at the creation of Obamacare, and they seemed largely absent in the reform repeal effort that ended up going nowhere. Do I remember their influence in 2009 correctly?
No, I think that's right. They certainly had a seat at the table with the Congress in trying to design Obamacare, and were very involved and ultimately got some things they liked, but also got some things they didn't like.
And why do you think they have not been an influential voice in the efforts to repeal Obamacare? I mean, is it basically the sum total of they don't want Obamacare fully repealed?
I think that's right. I mean, first of all, remember that a lot of the effort really behind the repeal of Obamacare was not just about repealing some of the regulations, which, of course, the insurers don't like, but also took a lot of money away. So it reduced the Medicaid spending as well as the amount of federal subsidies to go to pay for insurance. So when you take that kind of money out of the system, that just means less money in the system for insurers.
Got it. JB, give me a sense of this. Do most health insurers say, yeah, Obamacare has its problems, but it worked out pretty much as we expected? Or have they been confronted with some, you know, really unexpected realities from it?
Well, the deal that they made was, you give us more volume, give us all these uninsured people, mm-hmm. and we'll stop doing bad things you don't like. And the second part of the deal was, and the government would protect you for the first 3 years mm-hmm. and give you some assurances that things will work out right and take away some of the risk of these populations. You really don't know how they're going to work out. The government reneged on that, and that was the biggest issue, is that there were some risk reduction methods that were supposed to be paid thanks to some suits and some bad writing of legislation to begin with. The government paid 12 cents on the dollar for some of those backup plans. So basically, the insurance companies had to bear a whole lot more risk than what they bargained for, and they had to build into the rates the next year. And then the rates kept changing and the rules kept changing, and they've been in an incredibly uncertain business. And their business is taking care of risk, but they like to truncate it. And it's been open-ended, basically. That's their problem.
So, JB, here's the other question on that, though. I mean, as some of these insurers who came into plans like our exchange in Minnesota and others assessed the risk and the economics of this, did they... how should I put this? I mean, did they bring the right amount of due diligence to that? Because, I mean, we've seen health insurers pulling out here, and I know this is happening in other states, and it's because they're essentially saying they can't afford it.
Well, the plan was, and it was very sound, and we've done it before, was to have a three-year transition period. When Medicare expanded their coverage to drugs, the Medicare Part D plan, nobody had ever done this before. So they did exactly the same thing there that they copied for the Affordable Care Act. That is, they gave these risk reduction models, these three levels of risk reduction, in order to give the insurers the experience they need to be able to build the rates. So after 3 years, the plan was they would know the population, it would be stable, they know how to set their rates, and you take the training wheels off, and then they're on their own.
Okay.
With a couple exceptions. That never happened because we had chaos in the meantime. and so they never had a chance to really get the stable. Now, we're beginning, ironically, to have a stable market now.
Yeah,
so they're
right.
Beginning to know what those people are like. They're beginning to set their rates. And actually, what's called the medical loss ratio, that is how much they're spending on medical costs, has actually begun to stabilize. And some of the insurers are doing okay, thank you very much, right at the time when all this chaos is happening.
I'm going to come back to you, Sabrina, on that, because I have more to ask you about that. But I want to take a call here from Steve in Grand Marais. Steve, I was asking if you had the ear of your health insurers, what would you tell them about what you want and what you like and don't like? What are you thinking about?
Okay, here's your answer to expensive hospitals, doctors, and insurance companies.
Uh-huh.
It's the Surgery Center of Oklahoma.
How so?
If they decide you need a knee surgery, they'll tell you exactly what it's going to cost ahead of time. They don't take insurance. You pay the bill, here's what it's going to cost. They do the surgery, and they take care of you very well. They'll even fly you down there and back, and so you get great care, and you pay them directly.
Sabrina, that's a lot of transparency in healthcare costs, and I think that frustrates a lot of people about their health insurer. What do you think of that idea?
Oh, yeah, no, absolutely. And actually, this whole idea of centers of excellence, either regionally or nationally, we're seeing more and more health plans and even employers actually fly people to these centers all around the country and even in other countries and getting care much more affordably. And that works very well when you can plan in advance. But a lot of healthcare, of course, is not something that we necessarily plan for. So you have to design a system that works both for those expected costs and procedures as well as the unexpected.
Sabrina, I want to come back to what I was talking to JB about, which is this idea about insurers assessing their risks and taking part in these exchanges. In 2018, there are going to be 47 counties, it looks like, completely without an insurer. And again, I want to ask, how many of these insurer withdrawals from markets is because the insurers themselves weren't clear-eyed and practical enough about the cost of being part of the exchanges? Or is it, as JB is suggesting, the way this was executed didn't allow the health insurers to do what they thought they were going to be able to do?
Well, JB is absolutely right, and I think there was a lot more chaos and uncertainty in the first few years of the marketplaces than anybody anticipated. And Minnesota, of course, was a state where the insurance companies came in the first year with very low prices, in fact, the lowest in the country. So it's not surprising that as they get more data and understand their population a little bit better, that those prices are being adjusted upward. But JB is also right that going into 2017, where we are today, the things were really starting to stabilize nationwide with carriers getting a better handle on their population and pricing. But what's happening now is there's so much uncertainty coming out of Washington with threats from the Trump administration to cut subsidies
right.
And these repeal and replace efforts that insurers are just sort of throwing up their hands and saying, look, I've had this rocky road and I just can't take it anymore. So there's a real risk that the hard-earned stability that we've gained this year is all for naught.
So when you say that insurers are throwing up their hands, I mean, what does that mean practically for the way that they're thinking about 2018 and beyond? I mean, what kinds of decisions are they making because of that?
Well, of course, some are deciding to leave the market entirely or shrink their service areas. But we're also seeing a lot just build it into the premium rate. So we're seeing very, very hefty price hikes in markets across the country as carriers try to build in for that extra risk or of the uncertainty coming from Washington right now.
If you've just gotten in on the conversation here, we're talking about what insurers would like to see happen with health care reform now that it really does look like repeal is off the table. I'll ask our guests about that. If insurers had the kind of influence in what's happening now as they did in 2009 as Obamacare was being created, what do they want? What are they most concerned about? I think we've just heard Sabrina and JB say they're concerned about all the chaos and the upheaval at the moment around healthcare, but what else? And then I want to ask you, this is a chance for you to, I don't know, in some ways whisper in the ear of your health insurer and say, if there's going to be changes made, I'd like you to think about this. What would you tell them about what you like or you don't like about your insurance? What should insurers understand about how their consumers are thinking about the insurance? 800-242-2828, 651-227, 6000 on Twitter at Carrie NPR. Just want to let you know, Sabrina Corlett with us from Georgetown University's Health Policy Institute, and J.B. Silvers is a former CEO of a health insurance company and now a professor of healthcare finance at Weatherhead School of Management in Cleveland, Ohio, to Heather in Rochester. Hi, Heather. How are you thinking about this?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I am interested in HSAs. I'm very independent, so I think that they are killing us with premiums. And right now, with my husband's employer, we have no premium, and we contribute, because we have no premium, we contribute that money to an HSA.
Mm-hmm.
And because we chose a high deductible, they contribute to us $70 a month. So now we have this money in this HSA account to pay for the dentist, to pay for those doctor bills. I think that the government should get on board with that, that they should say, look, insurance companies, you go ahead and, like, if you're a lower income, you get a $5,000 deductible.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have an incentive to put money away because, let's say, they give you for every $100 you contribute to that HSA to pay for it.
You know something, Heather, I think you're pretty unusual in not having, did you say you don't have premiums or co-pays?
I have a zero premium.
That's really unusual. JB, what do you think about what she said?
Well, that's the Republican playbook. To get zero cost is really low. The trouble with health savings accounts is that, high deductible plans is that if everyone had one like Heather, it'd be nirvana. Even if you had one that was low premium and you could put a lot of money away and your employer was putting money away in the health savings account, that'd be good. What's in fact happened for many places is the employers have created high deductible health care plans that are HSA eligible. That is, you can set one up, but they're not putting money in the pot.
Right.
And for lower income employees, they don't have enough money to put in the pot either. So
right.
Most of those are unfunded. And therefore, it's just money off the bottom line, and they don't have the money to pay it when the time comes. So we're losing coverage for many people, but through high deductible, if they're lower income folks. Interestingly, Medicaid plans around the country, the states that are trying to revamp their Medicaid program under waiver programs, Indiana is the prototype for this, are setting up HSAs along with Medicaid plans and putting $1,000 or $2,000 in those accounts for Medicaid people to be using for exactly the same reason that Heather mentioned.
And the purpose of that is to cover so that you're not hit with a bill unexpectedly, and you're also starting to think about the cost and the use of your health care?
If it's my money, I'll be very careful with
it.
Got it. That's the principle.
Sabrina, we've done shows here about how deductibles influence the way people use their health care. And frankly, I'm surprised that our first call wasn't bring down those deductibles, you know, along with premiums. Have health insurers responded to what Americans are experiencing with these high deductibles?
Yes and no. I mean, unfortunately, deductibles, the trend is that they are on the rise, both in employer coverage as well as individual coverage. So that is the trend, and I don't expect it to reverse itself anytime soon as long as healthcare continues to be more and more expensive every year. I think what we are seeing some signs of is that insurers are waiving some services. In other words, they're saying, well, you know, we'll cover three primary care visits before the deductible, or we'll cover some generic drugs before the deductible. So there's some signs that they recognize that people need to have some access to care before they hit their deductible. And I think that is a helpful thing.
Sabrina, on Twitter here, Jeff says, why don't we ever talk about state-level single payer? Seems like New York and California could be big enough to pull it off. Why don't they?
Money. It comes down to money. You know, Vermont and California have both looked at single payer proposals, but the cost of financing those is a bridge too far, I think, for the politicians that have to make those decisions.
JB, I could hear you chuckling in the background there.
Well, it's always money.
Of course.
Boiled, particularly the state level. This is a very expensive thing to do. I think the way single payer might happen, the way I play it out, is the conventional insurance markets just fail because you're asking them to not just insure people that have unpredictable expenses, but you're asking them to finance the care for people that have predictable expenses. That is, more chronic care, more year-to-year expenses, perhaps even more genetic information. When we know that something's going to be taking place, then it's no longer a matter of insuring it. It's a matter of paying for it somehow or another. That may be the coup de grace on conventional insurance, is that the only way to bear that risk is at a more global level, a national level probably. And so the movement towards Medicare for all, one could imagine that that might be the impetus to have something like that actually get some traction over time.
So it's a
tough one.
So, JB, you look at what Senator Bernie Sanders is introducing here, and we've heard, you know, at the way the political dynamic stacks up now, it's probably never going to get a vote. But you look at the details of that bill and say, generally, this could work and health insurers might like this?
Oh, no, health insurers wouldn't like it at all. Because it's going to take business away from them. The only way they would like it is if it becomes a commercial product like Medicare Advantage plans. And then they would like it because the government's going to back it up and open up a new market for them. The question is, who bears the risk in the system? And so we're basically playing hot potato with this. High deductible plans move the risk to the patient for good reason, because you want them to be careful. But the employer traditionally has taken most of the risk. They're saying, hey, I don't want to do that forever. I'm in the business of widgets, not insurance. And so we're left with this never-never land where it's not clear who's going to bear the risk. And ultimately, if the risk gets too high, then you have no choice. There's nobody going to volunteer to take that risk, certainly not independent insurance companies. And we have market failure. And government typically steps in when there's a market failure of some sort.
Sabrina, Nancy says on Twitter, as an employer, I hate the role I have to play in my staff's health care. This kind of goes back to what JB was saying. It's uncomfortable for me and unfair to them. They deserve better. How could any kind of reform respond to that? Is it essentially, and Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel believes this, that we will be splitting health care insurance away from employers within 10 years. Do you agree with that?
Well, there's no question. I think if we were able to go back in time and start from scratch, I don't think anybody would design the employer-based system we have today. But there are a couple of hurdles to dismantling it. One, of course, that it is an incredibly popular benefit. It is right up there with your 401k plan as the most popular benefit. And it really is necessary for employers to have it as a recruitment and retention tool for employees. But the other big issue, of course, is that it is tremendously tax advantaged. So it's subsidized to the tune of $250 billion a year in lost tax revenue to the federal government. And so it is something that to dismantle, it's sort of become almost a third rail politically, because you'd be effectively taking away a big benefit for 150 million people.
Sabrina, I just want to make sure when we say this that listeners understand what we're saying. We get a benefit from our employer. It's a health care benefit. It's worth a lot, and we don't pay taxes on that.
That's right.
And they get deducted as an expense. So if you get to deduct it as an employer, then usually you have to pay a tax on it as an employee.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how salary works, for instance. But if for this form of compensation, they get to deduct it as an expense of doing business. You don't have to pay tax on it as an income.
And that is why Sabrina says it's an incredibly tax-advantaged benefit, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Better than the home tax deduction, I think, isn't it, Sabrina?
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, I believe it's the biggest federal tax subsidy out there today.
If you've just tuned into the conversation here, we're talking about on a day when new health reform bills are being introduced, one by Senator Lindsey Graham, one by Senator Bernie Sanders. We're talking about what would health insurers put into the mix if they had a seat at the table. I'm going to ask that directly to Sabrina and JB. We're covering a lot of the other elements that you're bringing up and some of the questions I have. And I'm asking you, if you had some communication with your own health insurer, what would you tell them about what you like, what you want, what you don't want, what you don't like? 651-227-6000. 800-242-2828. If you get a busy signal, you can reach me on Twitter at Carrie NPR. A look at the latest news, right back to your calls and your questions to Phil Picardi now. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Carrie. As you mentioned, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders is offering a bill to expand Medicare to provide health insurance for all Americans. Under the legislation, people would get health coverage by showing a new government-issued card. One of the main highways that connects Florida to the rest of the country is in danger of being closed due to flooding caused by Hurricane Irma. The Santa Fe River in north central Florida that runs under Interstate 75 has rapidly risen within the past 2 days. Officials say the water is likely to continue rising. Meanwhile, a nursing home in Florida is reporting 5 residents have died due to a power outage at the facility. The governor of the U.S. Virgin Islands says the state of New York will provide security assistance as the territory recovers from Hurricane Irma. New York is sending 100 state troopers and members of the New York National Guard to St. Thomas and St. John. French President Emmanuel Macron has promised to rebuild the Irma-wrecked island of St. Martin and diversify its economy away from tourism. Macron also promised to evacuate residents of his country's Caribbean territories and provide services and shelter for those who choose to stay. Hundreds of people have marched in India's capital demanding an end to violence against the Rohingya Muslims in Myanmar. Police stopped the group some distance from Myanmar's embassy. Rohingya face widespread persecution in Buddhist-majority Myanmar. And authorities say a suicide bomber has attacked a cricket stadium in the Afghan capital of Kabul, killing at least 2 people and wounding at least 7. Kabul police say the attack happened as hundreds of people were inside the stadium watching a cricket match. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 9:40.
Every Wednesday on All Things Considered, get a taste of regional food and drink trends, reviews, recipes, and advice. Our stable of food experts serve it up on Appetites. I'm Tom Cran. What's news and what's for dinner? Join me starting at 3.
I'm Tom Weber. Coming up, we'll have our latest conversation from Counter Stories. Today, we dive into the latest numbers from the latest survey. It showcases disparities in Minnesota. Join us at 11.
Our new national call-in show called Flyover is going strong. You can hear the first episode at flyoverradio.org. This week, 3 o'clock on Sunday, opening the phone lines to talk about Up by the Bootstraps. What about the mythology in America around American identity? Who's wealthy? Who's not? Who works hard? Who doesn't? Should hear from you and callers all across the country. 3 o'clock, Flyover on Sunday. I'll meet you there.
programming is supported by the Guthrie Theater, now playing Romeo and Juliet, Shakespeare's tale of star-crossed lovers directed by Joseph Hage. Performances of Romeo and Juliet begin September 9th. Tickets and more information at GuthrieTheater.org.
Back to our conversation now on where health insurers are on Obamacare reform. Sabrina, I'm just going to come to you straight out and ask you, what have we not covered yet about what health insurers want in a serious reform effort?
Well, the first thing I would say is, you know, the health insurance industry is not monolithic. Many of these companies come at this from different perspectives. Some are heavily into the Medicare or Medicaid business. Some are heavily into the Obamacare marketplaces. And so they don't have a monolithic view necessarily. I would say, though, that in general, what they're asking for is certainty on these subsidies, cost-sharing subsidies that mm-hmm. The Trump administration has threatened to cut off. I think they would like to see the individual mandate enforced. This is the requirement that people maintain health insurance or pay a fine. And I think they would like to see some subsidization of the market to help sort of smooth the risk of very, very high cost patients that are driving up premiums for the rest of us. So I would say those three things are the big asks right now from the industry in Congress.
Interesting what you said about the individual mandate, because as I recall, the fine basically for not getting health insurance has increased since Obamacare went into effect, but it's still not, I guess it's not so punitive that people aren't choosing to still go without health insurance. Is that right?
Yeah, that's generally right. I mean, I think the mandate penalty was never designed to be the same as or more than the year-long cost of a policy.
Right.
So it's currently $695 or 2.5% of your income, which generally is less than what you would pay for the cost of insurance.
And JB, of course, they want the individual mandate enforced because, as we've noted, that brings more people to insurers, right? And it spreads the risk pool out.
Right. If all you do is insure against people that are definitely going to be using health care, you're in trouble. So the idea of insurance is to get people in. It's a tough product. You're selling people a product that they hope they won't have to use. And then when you need it, you have to fight to get it back. So there's it's not a good product. No one falls in love with their insurance company. but if you don't get them in there, then you only get sick people and then you're in trouble. And so you have to find some way to get everybody in the pool. Most economists would say, well, it's to their self-benefit to join this because they can avoid that risk.
Right.
But when you're in a good position, you're young, you feel great, you know, who needs to pay this extra money out? Mm-hmm. So there's a big and then, frankly, the ACA was biased in its rate structure so that young people were paying a little bit more than they should have.
JB, what would you add to the list of what we've talked about, or have we covered pretty much what you think health insurers want out of any serious reform?
I think the stability is the biggest single thing, you know, predictability. I joke that the first actuary was Chicken Little. You know, they look at all the bad things that can happen. So you want to make sure you truncate what those bad things are and say, look, this is the maximum you're going to have to pay. You don't have to take care of these people that have pre-existing conditions. You can see why they did some of the things they did.
Mm-hmm.
Now you're saying, no, you have to do all that. That's your business. So they have to find some way to substitute that. And that's where some of these the reinsurance method that's been debated a lot is to step back in and pay for those exceptionally high difficult cases.
It sure sounds like, with both of you saying they want some certainty, that really doesn't look like it's coming. I mean, does it, JB?
Well, no, not at all. And the reaction is pretty predictable. When I have to bear more risk, I charge a higher premium.
Uh-huh.
And so the premiums have gone to the ceiling as much as anything, more than anything, because of the administration's policies and the Republican Congress, particularly the House, and some of their activities that have basically given the insurance some pretty stark choices. you know, I leave the market completely, which United up in your neighborhood has done.
That's right.
In terms of health care, in terms of the exchanges, I'll stay and see how it turns out. But I'll put a big premium in. And maybe if it turns out well, I'll make a lot of money. And if not, then I'll decide to leave. So they got until September 27th to say no thanks and get out. And some will still do that. Or I'll stay with a high premium, and that'll be enough to cover these extra risks. And by the way, if they get their act together, then I'll make a windfall profit.
Got it.
None of those are good choices. And they're totally avoidable. That's the sad part.
Brita says on Twitter, I don't choose to have chronic illness. Don't, and this is her speaking back to her health insurer. Don't shame me and cause me trouble for something I didn't want. And a physician who's listening in says HSAs are tough for chronic severe illness, diabetes, autoimmune, cancer, great for the healthy. To the phones here to Victoria in Chanhassen. Hi, Victoria. Thanks so much for waiting. Yeah, I know it's been
a
while. Thank you
for taking my call.
Sure. Go ahead.
I just wanted to comment that I've been a healthcare provider for 37 years, and having seen so many changes over those number of years, I'm really saddened at the place that we find ourselves at in this moment with healthcare insurance. My particular take on it is that I think the healthcare insurance companies had several seats at the table when they put together the most recent iteration of policies. And I think that it comes down, honestly, if they wanted something at the table today, I think they would say that they want more profits. I think the whole thing is about profit. I really, really do. And I work for nonprofit right now, and I see the people who are so hurt by the fact that they have no access to health insurance. They cannot afford it, but yet they fall through the cracks. And I think that many of my colleagues who are clinicians are very much in favor of single payer. And I think that we will move to single payer one way or another. It's going to happen at some point. There was a wonderful PBS show last night about physicians and clinicians who are putting together their own healthcare systems in certain parts of the country and bypassing the insurance companies. And I think that we'll see healthcare providers, clinicians have more seats at the table this time around.
Okay, Victoria, thanks for that. Two points that I want to bring back to you, Sabrina. It's all about profits, she says, and she comes back to single payer. Is it all about profits for the health insurers?
Well, there are for-profit and non-profit health insurers. On the single payer front, I agree. There are lots of clinicians out there that I think would like to see us move certainly towards a system like that. But bear in mind that at least here in Washington, one of the most strident voices opposed to single payer, and in fact the biggest opponent of Medicare when we did it back in '65, was the American Medical Association. So providers have historically not wanted a government expansion as a payer, I think largely out of concern that the government not just becomes a payer, but becomes a setter of reimbursement rates for providers, and they worry about that. I think that the single payer movement still has a long way to go. And the devil is very much in the details.
JB, I want to ask you about something that we haven't heard as much about lately, but I'm sure the rhetoric will fire up again. We used to hear Republicans who oppose Obamacare say consistently, and the president said this too, Obamacare is collapsing. It's in a death spiral. Both of you have said the market was actually stabilizing. Is that just wrong? When we say that Obamacare is in a death spiral?
Well, it's in a death spiral in the sense that you have more people that demand more, that have bigger needs, higher costs, and fewer people that have less. It's the insurance pool. So the insurance pool is breaking down. You know, this whole thing about the insurance, we focus on insurance so much. The last caller reflects the general popular view that insurance companies are making a margin of killing.
Mm-hmm.
The average profit margin for insurance companies is about 3%. It's really small. It's about payment and not profit. And that goes back to efficiency and market power. Is it efficient to use commercial insurance companies to do this when Medicare can do it for a whole lot less overhead cost? Well, you can make that good argument. About 80% of the premium that goes into private insurance has to be passed down in terms of medical cost. Well, why 20?
Mm-hmm.
Why have 20% when Medicare can do it for 5%? That's an efficiency argument. But the other one, and the thing that people don't want to talk about because they love their doctor and they don't like their insurance company, is it's market power. And so we've had consolidation across the industry into large systems. They're basically able to demand much higher premiums, much higher payment from the insurance companies. And those higher prices that we're making payments to providers are the biggest single thing, particularly in the last 5 years, in terms of increasing costs.
Okay, I want to make sure I understand what you just said, JV. You said there's been a lot of consolidation in the provider. These are the hospitals and other medical systems who are joining together and consolidating. And tell me, you were saying the demands that they have for reimbursement from the insurers has been a big factor in healthcare costs.
Exactly, particularly for the commercial side.
But
also for other plans. When you're the dominant provider, you have to have that dominant provider in your network as
mm-hmm.
an insurer.
Mm-hmm.
So you go to them and say, I'd like to negotiate a better rate from you. And they say, no, I don't think so. We want another 10% this year. And what are you going to do? You got to have them in your network.
Huh.
A physician that was independent and now his practice has been acquired by a large system is now using their market power to negotiate higher rates. They didn't have any leverage at all before. Now they've got the power of the large system, and they're getting more money. So you can't talk about just the insurance company. You've got to talk about the structure of the provider side, and we don't want to do that because it's so messy. And the argument of being more efficient and being more convenient. No, there are a lot of good arguments
it's
for why we should do that.
Yeah.
The market, though, on the other hand, and the good economists would say, you get rid of competition, prices go up.
Sabrina, what would you add to that?
No, I think JB's absolutely right. And what's essentially been happening is providers, as they merge and consolidate in different markets, they are using that clout to demand higher reimbursement from commercial carriers. Medicare, of course, sets the rate. It's a rate setter, and the providers are sort of forced to take it because the Medicare is the big 600-pound gorilla.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the reasons why you see provider groups like the American Medical Association so opposed to things like single payer is because they worry that they would have to take big cuts in their reimbursement, which they've been successfully able to extract year after year from the commercial payers.
Mm-hmm.
So that's part of why it's such a tricky job, and the financing and the money issue is a big one with these single-payer proposals.
Call here from Jill in Brooklyn Park. And Jill, thanks so much for waiting. What are you thinking about?
I have 3 points that relate to everything you've talked to about, so I'll try to be brief.
Quickly, Jill, because I'm almost out of time.
Okay, so the pricing, as a consumer, from anything from routine to chronic, you have no idea what you're paying and what your decisions result in financially,
mm-hmm.
that being a big issue. The Children's and Blue Cross Blue Shield just went through this, and how many dollars are spent on lawyers to negotiate pricing? So that relates to your last point.
Right.
I, too, am concerned about profits in healthcare, but it's not only the percentage that they make. It's the CEO salaries. Go to the McGuire stage anytime, and you'll know in Minnesota where some of our healthcare dollars have gone.
Mm-hmm.
And then 3, tying our healthcare to our jobs really does handcuff a consumer because you have disruption in your healthcare every time you change a job. So why not take that tax subsidy that you mentioned and apply it towards a consistent healthcare process that works for all?
Okay.
Those are my comments.
Yeah, thanks very much. I want to come back to the transparency part of this, Sabrina, because we hear this every time we do a healthcare show. And the answer that I get back from experts like you is, Well, these big consolidated providers negotiate kind of individual rates with insurers. And that's why you can't just call up a provider and say, what is it going to cost to have my appendix out and get some kind of consistent pricing across the line? Is that right?
That's absolutely right. They charge different amounts for different services depending on who's paying the bill. And it's almost impossible in most places for consumers to figure out what their bottom line costs are going to be for like a hospital stay or a surgery or
That's so infuriating. I mean, you know, because more of the responsibility for using healthcare wisely is supposed to come back to the patient, it's really frustrating to then have the kind of barrier that we've just talked about to understanding pricing.
You know, beyond
right. Well,
that
doesn't
though,
even get at the problem of a lot of times you go to an in-network hospital that's supposed to, you know, charge in-network rates, but you get serviced by an anesthesiologist or a pathologist who's not in-network, and you get hit with a big surprise bill that you weren't expecting, and that happens way too often also.
JB, I have 45 seconds. Go ahead.
Well, I'm just going to say the other part beyond that, which is clearly the big issue, is I can't predict what I'm going to spend. I don't know what I'm going to, what I need. I go to the doctor because I don't know what's wrong.
Yeah.
So you're going to have some services that we can do what's called bundled payment. Joints are the big ones. So joint replacements, you'll find consistent prices given on those that'll increasingly be the norm. They're largely driven by Medicare. For some things that are very definable, but for other things that are open-ended, I'm stuck with, again, buying a product that I don't know what I really need.
This was really helpful and informative. Sabrina, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
JB, really glad you could join us today. I thank you for all the information.
Great. Thank you. Bye.